Imagine holding the exclusive rights to this completely beloved multi-million dollar film franchise, and you decide, you know what? I'm going to adapt this for the stage, but I'm going to completely rip out the one specific thing that made it famous.
The music.
Exactly, the iconic music. You just replace it entirely. I mean, on paper, that sounds like absolute box office suicide.
Oh yeah. You're intentionally just tossing away all that built-in nostalgia that, you know, guarantees ticket sales.
Right. But today we're looking at how that exact massive risk didn't just work, but it actually created a global theatrical juggernaut.
It really did. It's honestly the ultimate case study in how to engineer a bulletproof joy machine for the stage.
Yeah.
Because adaptation isn't just about like copying and pasting a movie script into a theater. It requires finding an entirely new heartbeat.
Completely. And welcome to this deep dive, custom tailored just for you. Today, we have a really fascinating stack of source material.
Yeah, we do.
It's this comprehensive encyclopedia breakdown detailing the history of a modern phenomenon. We are talking about Sister Act, a divine musical comedy.
Such a great show.
It really is. And our mission today is to explore the anatomy of this massive hit. We're going to track how a cherished 1992 Whoopi Goldberg film was just completely dismantled, relocated, and set to a totally different beat to conquer the global stage.
And we'll also examine the surprising, tangible, real-world community impact it had along the way.
Yeah, that part is wild. Okay, let's unpack this.
So to really understand the mechanics of this show, you have to look at its incubation. It didn't just, you know, spring up fully formed with marquee lights in New York or London.
Right, it didn't start on Broadway.
No, not at all. It had this very calculated, iterative testing phase.
Yeah.
The show actually had its regional premiere back in 2006 at the Pasadena Playhouse in California.
And looking at the data from the sources, it absolutely crushed that regional test.
Oh, completely.
It broke records. It grossed over $1 million. I think the
Yeah.
exact number was $1,085,929.
Wow.
Yeah. Becoming the highest grossing show ever at that venue. But, you know, I don't want to just read out box office statistics.
Right, because it means more than that.
Exactly. That $1 million gross isn't just trivia. That is the ultimate proof of concept data. That's
Yeah.
the hard number that gives investors the confidence to take a massive leap because the creative team made some fundamental, like, structural changes from the original film.
They absolutely did. I mean, the core narrative spine remains intact, right?
Yeah.
You have Dolores Van Cartier, who is this lounge singer who crowns herself Lady Fabulous.
Lady Fabulous,
She
yeah.
witnesses her gangster boyfriend murder someone. She goes to the police, connects with Sweaty Eddie, and goes into witness protection at the Holy Order of the Little Sisters of Our Mother of Perpetual Faith.
Such a mouth.
It really is.
Yeah.
But that narrative architecture is the same. The big thing is the creative team completely shifted the temporal and geographical setting.
Right.
They moved it back in time to 1970s Philadelphia, and actually, eventually 1978 for the West End version.
And that time jump, that's what allowed for the biggest swing of all, because composer Alan Menken and lyricist Glenn Slater entirely scrapped the iconic Motown covers from the film.
Yes, they just threw them out.
They completely threw out the songs the audience was expecting to hear. Like, there is no My Guy turned into My God.
No.
Instead, they replaced the entire soundtrack with an original score heavily steeped in like 70s disco, soul, and R&B. But I really have to push back on this choice, though.
Okay, let's hear it.
Like, doesn't removing the literal music that made the 1992 film a hit risk entirely alienating the built-in fan base?
A fair question.
I mean, a jukebox musical would have been so much safer. You just play the hits. Why take that risk?
What's fascinating here is the specific genius of Alan Menken and the difference between musical integration and musical insertion.
Okay, break that down on me.
Well, if you look at Menken's pedigree, he is the absolute master of period pastiche. He did the exact same thing with Little Shop of Horrors, right?
Oh, true.
He captured that early 60s doo-wop sound to really heighten the theatricality. So by shifting Sister Act to 1970s Philly soul, Menken and Slater allowed the music to drive the narrative forward organically.
So if I'm tracking this, you're saying an original score functions like a custom-tailored suit that allows the characters a full range of motion,
Yes.
whereas a jukebox musical is like trying to squeeze a story into a really rigid pre-made suit.
Precisely. Nostalgia can get people into the seats, sure, but it rarely sustains a 2.5 hour emotional arc on a stage.
That makes sense.
A jukebox musical often forces the writer to bend the plot into unnatural shapes just to, you know, justify the lyrics of a pre-existing pop song.
Right, like shoehorning a song in because the audience expects it.
Exactly. But with an original score, Dolores can sing a song like Fabulous Baby, which perfectly, specifically establishes her exact dreams of stardom in the 70s club scene.
Oh, I see.
It isn't just a vague pop anthem. It's her character's internal monologue set to a disco beat.
Mm-hmm.
It gives the characters a musical vocabulary that is entirely unique to their psychological needs in that exact moment.
That makes a lot of sense. The music becomes the actual engine of the plot rather than just a nostalgic paint job.
Exactly.
And clearly this new custom-built engine was humming perfectly in Pasadena, but, you know, regional success is still regional.
Mm.
To test if this newly engineered joy machine had true global legs, the production made a really fascinating geographic leap. They bypassed Broadway entirely.
Yeah, which is huge.
Right, and they headed straight for London's West End.
It was a highly strategic move.
Mm.
By bypassing New York, they avoided the immediate, like, intense pressure cooker of Broadway critics.
Oh, shit.
But they were still testing the show in a world-class theatrical market. The show opened at the London Palladium in June 2009, and it was produced by Stage Entertainment and Whoopi Goldberg herself.
And it comes with this incredible Cinderella story attached to the casting.
Oh, I love this part.
Right, because in the ensemble of that Pasadena run was a young woman named Patina Miller,
yep,
who was also just understudying the lead role of Dolores. Fast forward to London, and after this massive search, Patina Miller is elevated to the principal star of the West End production.
It's amazing.
The understudy takes the global stage.
It's the ultimate theatrical dream realized. But while Miller's personal ascent was universally celebrated by the press, the critical reception of the show itself in London was deeply fractured.
Fractured is putting it politely. It was a bloodbath of contrasting opinions. On one side, you have Charles Spencer in the Telegraph absolutely cheering for it. He said it, quote, proves more enjoyable on stage than it did on film. He praised the book. He loved the disco-inspired score. He literally asked in his review, frankly, what's not to like, especially when you've got a chorus line of jiving nuns singing their hearts out ecstatically.
It's a great quote. But then...
Oh, boy, here it comes.
Then you have Michael Billington of The Guardian.
Yes. Billington gave it a brutal 2 out of 5 stars.
Ouch.
He called it noisily aggressive and a vulgarized incarnation.
Wow.
His main grievance was the pacing and the structure. He complained that the plot completely grinds to a halt so the nuns can sing a song called How I Got the Calling.
Right.
And the cops can stop the story to sing about their macho fantasies and I could be that guy.
Yeah.
He basically accused the show of padding out a slight story just to give everyone a solo.
It's a really harsh critique. But, you know, we have to look at where Billington is coming from.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I want to vigorously attack Billington's review here.
Go for it.
Isn't he completely missing the fundamental point of this specific genre of musical theater? Musicals are supposed to be big, loud, aggressive expressions of emotion.
Right, they're not quiet.
They aren't subtle indie film realism. When Sweaty Eddie sings, I could be that guy. He isn't stopping the plot. He's showing us his internal desperation.
Mm.
When Dolores teaches the timid sister Mary Robert to sing, that isn't filler. That's the emotional peak of the character arc. It feels like Billington walked into a disco and complained that it wasn't a library.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what you are identifying is the internal foundational tension in theater criticism.
The classic battle.
Exactly, the battle between commercial entertainment and high art.
Hmm.
But I will actually defend Billington's perspective for a moment here.
Okay, I'm listening. Defend the 2-star review.
So his critique reflects a very specific traditionalist view of musical theater integration.
Hmm.
Think about the revolution in musical theater in the mid-20th century. Pioneers like Rodgers and Hammerstein and later Stephen Sondheim, they fought incredibly hard to make sure that songs and story were perfectly seamlessly integrated. In their shows, a song must advance a rigorous intellectual plot. You don't just stop and sing for the sake of singing.
Got it.
So when Billington sees a side character like Sweaty Eddie get a massive fantasy sequence, he sees a regression. He sees a throwback to, like, 1920s vaudeville, where the narrative halts entirely just to give the audience a flashy variety act. From his standpoint, it's undisciplined writing.
I see the logic there. He's looking for strict narrative momentum.
Yes.
But I'd counter that Sister Act isn't trying to be Sweeney Todd. The noise he complains about is actually the thesis of the show. The entire point of the story is that loud, joyful expression brings isolated people together. The spectacle is the substance.
And the audience ultimately agreed with you. Despite the critical snobbery from the traditionalists, the show's effectiveness as a communal experience was undeniable.
Oh, absolutely.
It secured 4 Laurence Olivier Award nominations, including Best New Musical and Best Actress in a Musical for Bettina Miller. The audience recognized that this supposed commercial vulgarity was actually a highly crafted, highly effective piece of joy.
Yeah. London proved the music worked, and the audiences loved the energy. But, you know, Billington's harsh review did highlight a potential fatal flaw in the pacing.
Yes, it did.
The creative team clearly realized they couldn't take the show to Broadway, which is the ultimate theatrical gauntlet, without fixing those structural issues.
This is where we see the iterative nature of theater at its absolute peak.
Right.
They didn't just pack up the London sets in shipping containers and, you know, move them to New York.
Right, they didn't just transfer it.
No, they completely reopened the hood of the car. They brought in a new director, Jerry Zaks.
And Jerry Zaks is key here because he had previously worked with Alan Menken on the Broadway production of Little Shop of Horrors.
Exactly.
So you immediately have an established shorthand between the director and the composer.
Right. And to fix the structural issues Billington pointed out, they brought in playwright Douglas Carter Bean to rewrite the book. They made significant load-bearing adjustments to the narrative architecture.
Let's unpack those changes because they aren't just minor dialogue tweaks.
No, they're massive.
In London version, there was a prologue where the mother superior declares the convent is in need, and Dolores is just hoping her boyfriend will introduce her to a record producer for her birthday. But on Broadway, they shift the timeline entirely to Christmas Eve.
Which is a brilliant structural adjustment.
It really is.
Because why set it at Christmas? Because Christmas is culturally centered around gathering, family, and the mixing of the secular and the sacred.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
By placing Dolores, a woman entirely focused on her own secular fame, in a convent right at Christmas, you heighten her isolation. It adds a ticking clock and deepens the emotional resonance of her eventual integration into this new, quote-unquote, family of nuns.
They also changed the gangster's name from Curtis Shank to Curtis Jackson,
yeah.
Which feels like they were adjusting the mobster archetype for an American audience. Like, Shank sounds like a gritty 90s street thug.
Yeah, very harsh.
But Jackson sounds like a smoother 70s soul record producer villain, which perfectly fits the new Menken score. They even overhauled the song list, right? They added a crucial new track for the Mother Superior called Haven't Got a Prayer.
That addition is vital. It fleshes out her internal struggle, making her more than just a strict antagonist. It allows the audience to really empathize with the immense pressure she feels trying to maintain order in a changing world.
It grounds her.
Exactly. And all of these tweaks resulted in a much tighter, more emotionally resonant adaptation when it finally opened at the Broadway Theater in April 2011.
And Bettina Miller made her Broadway debut.
She did, reprising Dolores. And she earned a Tony Award nomination for Best Performance by a Leading Actress in a Musical.
It's just a massive triumph of iterative engineering. But the Broadway run and the subsequent global tours highlight another incredibly fascinating piece of system design in this show.
Oh, the casting.
Yes. It became famous for its high-profile celebrity replacements.
The industry term is stunt casting.
Right, stunt casting. On Broadway, Raven Simone eventually replaced Bettina Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And in the various international tours and revivals, you have heavyweights like Beverly Knight and Alexander Burke taking on Dolores.
Huge stars in the UK.
Huge. You have British comedy royalty like Ruth Jones and Jennifer Saunders donning the habit as the Mother Superior. And Whoopi Goldberg herself stepped in to play the Mother Superior in London.
Full circle moment.
Seriously. It reminds me of Doctor Who. The core character remains the same, the universe is the same, but the entire show changes flavor depending on the celebrity wearing the face, or in this case, the habit.
This raises an important question about the business mechanics of commercial theater. How much of a show's longevity relies on celebrity stunt casting to sell tickets versus the structural integrity of the musical itself?
Well, let's look at the economics of it. Broadway shows cost tens of millions of dollars to capitalize.
It's not cheap.
When the original, critically acclaimed cast leaves, investors usually panic because ticket sales naturally plummet. If a show relies entirely on the original actor's specific quirks to work, it just dies.
Which is why critics often view celebrity replacements cynically as a desperate, artistic compromise to keep a sinking ship afloat.
Right.
And sometimes that is entirely true. But with a show like Sister Act, the iterative engineering process we just discussed, the Douglas Carter Bean rewrites, the Alan Menken score, it created a structural framework that is incredibly sound.
Mm.
The roles of Dolores and the Mother Superior were built to act as massive, sturdy containers for star power.
Oh, I really love that concept, a sturdy container. Like,
yeah.
A weak show crumbles under a big star because the star essentially becomes the show and the flimsy plot collapses under their weight. But a strong show acts as a solid framework that the star is allowed to just color in.
Exactly.
Like, Beverly Knight is going to bring a legendary British soul powerhouse vocal to Dolores that completely changes the acoustic energy of the room. Meanwhile, Jennifer Saunders as the Mother Superior is going to bring a razor-sharp, satirical, comedic timing to the dialogue. The room gets painted a different color, but the walls never get knocked down.
Exactly. It's an incredibly smart piece of system design. It creates a franchise model that allows the show to run for years across multiple continents.
And speaking of structural integrity, a truly great structure doesn't just hold celebrities. It has the power to hold an entire community.
Oh, definitely.
Because the ultimate mark of a cultural phenomenon isn't just surviving Broadway. It's when the energy of the stage spills out into the real world and literally takes over the streets. Which brings us to the Sister Act Nun Run.
This is one of the most fascinating promotional events in modern theater history. In May 2009, just before the West End opening, the production partnered with the Bernardo's Children's Charity.
Almost 1,000 people dressed up in full nun habits to run a 4-mile route through the streets of London.
It's such an incredible image.
It really is. It wasn't some like curated TikTok dance challenge or a sterile Instagram ad. It was 1,000 people in habits running past the Tower of London, the Tate Modern, and St. Paul's Cathedral.
Yeah.
They raised over £30,000 for the charity, and it became an annual event. The Sister Act cast and the Barnardo's Children's Choir would even perform at the start line.
And the key here is that it was explicitly designed as a fun, community-driven event rather than a competitive cutthroat race.
Wait, let me make sure I'm connecting the dots here. If the entire thematic arc of the musical is about Dolores, the selfish singer who only cares about her own fame, being forced into a group and learning the profound value of community and sisterhood.
Yes.
Are you saying this marketing stunt was basically a live action test of the script?
That is exactly what I'm saying. If we synthesize why that specific marketing stunt works so beautifully, it's because it perfectly mirrored the show's thesis.
Yeah.
The musical is about a fractured group of individuals coming together to create a harmony they couldn't achieve alone. Translating that into a real-world event where a community of strangers from all walks of life gather together, put on identical habits, and run as a collective to help vulnerable children, that takes the core message of the stage show and makes it a lived, physical reality for the audience.
It's not just a marketing gimmick, it's a physical extension of the story.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for you, our listener? I think the journey of Sister Act is a masterclass in the messy, brilliant process of creation and system design.
True.
It did not become a global hit overnight. It required breaking records in Pasadena to gather data, then testing global waters in London, absorbing harsh critical feedback about pacing,
mm-hmm.
executing massive structural rewrites for Broadway, and designing roles sturdy enough to hold an ever-rotating cast of stars. Whether you are building a business, writing a book, or designing a product, it's a powerful reminder that success is rarely a straight line.
No, it never is.
It requires constant tweaking. You have to be willing to completely dismantle your own assumptions, throw out the old music, and adapt to your audience until the engine purrs.
And as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final thought to explore on your own.
Let's hear it.
In the second act of the musical, there's a phenomenal, quiet to loud song sung by the timid sister Mary Robert called The Life I Never Led.
Such a great song.
It really is. For her entire life, she has taken orders blindly, stayed quiet, and lived safely in the background. But inspired by the chaos of Dolores, she finally sings about refusing to suppress her own desires anymore.
It's a total powerhouse moment of self-discovery.
So I ask you, the listener, if you were suddenly forced into witness protection tomorrow, stripped of your phone, your clothes, your job title, and the daily routine you hide behind what hidden loud disco-sized voice or talent might you discover that you've been suppressing all along?
What a phenomenal question to end on. We spend so much time polishing the outside of the machine, we sometimes forget to see what kind of engine we're really hiding under our own hood. Thanks for diving deep with us today. Until next time, keep listening, and keep unpacking the world around you.